The Stick a Fork in It podcast is a presentation of Feeding Tampa Bay.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Stick a Fork in It, the official podcast of Feeding Tampa Bay. I feel like it's been a minute.
Yeah.
The listeners don't feel like it has because we record in advance sometimes, but I feel like it's been a minute.
Yeah, I know. Good to see. Good to be around the table with you, Ev.
Always glad to be here.
Yeah.
So what do we got going on today?
I don't know how I feel about being here with you.
Yeah, just wandered in.
Yeah. So by the time this airs, we'll have been through a variety of different things over the summer, over the fall, and you know, the question that I get asked most whenever we have a discussion with friends and typically reporters, underneath the question is, how bad is it?
Yeah.
And so I'm often reminded of a terrific line from a movie that I really don't know the movie well, although it's one of the few animated movies I've ever seen, Toy Story.
Oh, yeah.
Or Woody and Buzz are discussing in the middle of a particular crisis. Woody says, now's no time to panic. Mm-hmm. And Buzz says, now's the perfect time to panic.
Right. Should be panicking.
Which I think theologically is one of the smartest things I've ever heard. But I am thinking a lot about life stress, work stress, people stress. So I thought I would ask the two of you a question.
Mm-hmm.
What are your de-stressing techniques?
Yeah.
Actually, you could start with what is stressing you right now, distressing you.
A shorter list is what isn't.
Wow. We know where his headspace
is. Yeah. So guess is you're paying attention to the politics of the moment and of the—
How do you hide from it? You know?
Yeah.
You can't escape it.
Do you think you could just stop? Do you think you could cold turkey and just stop reading news?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You could?
I think I could. But I would have to be far away from everything, like in a cabin.
I would be convinced.
Yeah,
I
see him in a cabin one day in the middle of nowhere, just absolutely joyful with his garden.
Good comes of that. I think
I would freak out, but Ev, on the other hand, would be like in his most zen.
How big would your beard get? Would you let it go?
At least navel length, I think. Yeah, hopefully.
Wow.
Yeah, and that would happen in like 3 weeks.
I think we're interested in that as a general theme. If you would like to do that, we'd be interested in seeing how long your beard
We'll track it on social.
There you go.
So out of a possible billion different things, only about one or two are not causing you stress. How is your stress of your world, Shannon?
Similar. I'm not going to go live in the middle of nowhere and not have electricity. But, you know, there's just a lot going on. There's a lot of noise. I think people respond differently when there's a lot of stress. So you have to kind of prepare for that. So it's, you know, right now it's pretty heavy.
It does feel that way. It certainly does. Yeah, it does. Mm. There's no doubt about that. I think we can feel it here with our colleagues. You can see it.
Mm. With our neighbors.
Yeah, yeah, it's a sense of, right, it's, you know, I was trying to think about different times when people as a community and as societies felt happier.
Mm.
Like
what
were those time frames where people felt a greater sense of hope? You know, but certainly we're aware of when we feel a different sense of heaviness. So importantly for the listener, this podcast is all about thoughtful solutions, big ideas. What do you do to de-stress?
Yeah. I think that I try to like ground myself and do like activities with friends that are like creative. Obviously, for me, like I recently.
So you like doing the folded origami?
Lots of origami. No, I have no patience.
Is this craft? Is this craft?
Definitely
related?
Crafts.
Crafts. Okay.
Lately, I just discovered paint pens. You don't have to do like the whole brush and everything. There's like pens that have paint in them. It's like a marker, but it's like better.
So diving into a piece of art.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I have a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
Reading fiction.
This is a shorter show.
So. Short answer.
Well, it's our show, so I can. Okay.
That's true.
So that also art, painting, and then finally, what would a show be without me talking about my chickens? Coffee and my chickens. So you know, it's just kind of checking out, if you will.
Yeah.
Taking my mind to a different place. It can't be TV or anything because or watching Toy Story because I'll sit there and when I start, I'll go weaving off into what's going on. So, we all need places to check out in.
Yeah.
So one of my favorites, haircut.
Oh, what?
sitting in a barber's chair is one of the most relaxing things in my entire life. I have no interest
that
in
– That is definitely a dude thing.
Absolutely not. I hate going to the parlor.
Right.
It is Clara just, is here.
Our guest is stepping in against all the rules.
She has a strong opinion.
Absolutely. I hate going to the parlor.
Right.
Sitting down and just having someone cut your – I mean, I also like to get my nails done.
Okay, yeah.
Fingers and toes?
No toes. Nobody's touching the boots.
Really?
That's the hard no. Yeah. I don't understand at all how someone can like start. Yeah, that's a big no. But particularly when I used to work in New York City and my job stress was reasonably high, mm-hmm. I would often leave and go do one of two things if it was very difficult. One is I would get my nails done, mm-hmm. Including a little application of
little polish or a little buff?
No, a little polish.
There you go.
Oh,
yeah.
A little clear polish. Yeah.
Or I'd go get my shoes shined, which is an art form.
Yeah.
It is on a really good shoe, a shoe shine is an art form. But it was interesting that as I think about all three of those things, there is a it's almost a mechanical process that I find interesting. And what you guys were both talking about with art is a mechanical process, right?
Definitely.
You're suddenly involved in something where there are steps to it or there are – right? So your mind engages completely differently in that – you know, I guess if you – I don't paint, but you're laying a base or you're – whatever it is, you're doing certain things that have to have a
concentration, a focus?
No. Consecutive steps that you have to start to build out. It's one of the reasons why I still like to I don't cut my lawn anymore, but I still like to do all the shrubbery trimming and all that kind of stuff because I can see right that
get moment. The joy from it.
Yeah.
So our guest
– Yeah, but I have a question really quick.
Yes.
Compare your stress at Feeding Tampa Bay to working on Wall Street.
Oh, yeah.
Is it very different or is it?
Yes, they are. The stress that we tend to feel in this job is spiritual and psychic.
Yes. Yes.
Right? When you do this work, you're entering into a place with people where you understand the implications and ramifications of what's going on in their world. And when you do this, and our guests, when they're invited in to speak – our guest.
You knew this going in.
Right. Our guest.
I mean, come on.
I think, you know, when you do this work, you enter into a space where you're willing to and have to accept the emotional obligation of the of the work. Mm-hmm. Right. You can't do what anybody does in the social services arena without a sense of investment in heart. Those that do and try to do it, it's quickly, you know, it's interesting. You find out quickly that's not who they are.
Mm. Right.
And they struggle in our world because those we serve are really asking something of us. Those we serve with are asking something of us. Mm-hmm. And so the stress and pressure on Wall Street was a ego-based pressure, right? You're in a place where you're asked to achieve certain results, have certain things happen. There's a status associated with all of that. Mm-hmm. There's a – right? So it's a different kind of pressure. But I would say it's more external pressure, which the pressure I feel today is more internal pressure.
Right.
Probably I could have said that at the start and it'd been a much better answer.
No, but I think explaining it is important because especially for those of us that work in nonprofit that have been doing it for a long time.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of joy, right? But there's a lot of heartbreak and you take it home, right? So can't help it.
Ev, I have a question for you.
Okay.
And this is a show that has honesty involved in
it. Yeah.
Have you ever thought of setting up an alter ego and then posting that way?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Oh. Whoa.
Yeah.
Some of your stress management I've thought of this often, just for the record.
Yeah.
I'm going to set up – although I don't know how to do it. I'm going to set up a –
I was going to say, you are?
I don't know how to do any of it. I've thought about doing this where I could just post whatever it is that I'm thinking.
That's what the internet is for.
And no one will really know.
That's what Twitter is all about.
I was listening
Clearly
to
there's people that don't –
I was listening to another radio show, and they were there were four of them on a sports show, and there were four or five of them on, and one of them was maintaining the position that he should be able to drive in the left-hand lane at whatever speed he wants. So
I'm
long
with
as
him.
No. The left-hand lane is a passing lane. It is not a driving lane. He was trying to make it a driving lane.
It is a driving lane.
It is not
a
driving lane.
It's a personal choice.
It is not a driving lane.
I remember this part of the D&D test.
Mm. I want to be able to post about stuff like that. In fact, I'd like to include videos of people like Shannon, who's driving in the left-hand lane, just cruising along,
right,
unaware
and
that
I'll
traffic,
wave at you.
Traffic right. behind them is piling up for
No, I don't ever do that.
She
no,
goes
I'm,
as fast
I'm a,
as possible in the left
yeah,
hand lane.
Yeah, you just can't catch me.
But sometimes I wonder if having an alter ego online would de-stress, does it?
Yes, but you got to be careful. It's like the Batman thing. Like, do you become you or are you Batman now? Like, which person are you leaning into more? Are you becoming
I would like
your
to be Batman?
Yeah, I see.
Who
that's
doesn't
the thing.
Want to be Batman?
But then you start to lose your Bruce Wayne. You know, you wouldn't be Thomas anymore.
Wow, that's good.
So you end up becoming you have
you guys,
a Jekyll and Hyde thing
I know,
going.
That's,
oh,
mm-hmm. okay. Can we, our guest needs to come yes. in and part of this
She's
conversation.
Over
she is
there.
Like,
all right.
Oh no, I'm having
it's
a
great conversation.
Welcome you.
Talk about de-stress.
Yes. Right,
Clara. We have the perfect person here
right.
today.
Right
from the Crisis Center of Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. So tell us about how you de-stress.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's I appreciate this conversation, and Thomas, I understand where you're coming from the perspective of having I have no other background but this work.
Okay.
I think I and because I live in a crisis place
yeah.
where it is, I mean that's just what we do. I think I've gotten to a place having been there for 10 years of just kind of going, "Oh, this is a new one."
Mm.
But we'll figure wow. it out.
Yeah.
So it what used to like just make me want to break out into hives all the time. I think I've learned of because we've got a good team, because we can, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
It's just, I didn't see this one coming. Mm. Okay. Because yeah. that's sometimes the only thing I can do
yeah.
is just change my mindset of moving forward. And I think in this political time that we're in, you guys may disagree with me. And that's absolutely fine. I have very limited control in what is happening in Washington.
Yeah. Yeah.
I very limited control what's happening in Tallahassee.
Mm-hmm.
But the pieces that we can control, that's really where the joy is. And how
gotcha.
Do we take what we can do to make our neighbors, our community members, get to a better place where they find their own hope?
Yeah.
Because that for us is really how people can change what could be the worst day of their lives into, yeah, this really sucked, but I can get through it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we know one way that Clara de-stresses.
Yeah. Right? You told me about it and I was blown
yeah.
away because I was going to try to get a hold of her and you were like, oh, she's doing this swim.
Mm.
But it's not just a swim, not laps
she's
in a pool.
She's an amphibian.
Yes. Yes. So
there's
I'm
swimmers,
so
then
intrigued.
There's amphibians. There's, hey, there's a pool. It seems warm and the water's bubbly. I'll step into it. Let me relax.
Yeah.
And then there's...
So please
Absolutely.
Tell us. So first of all, swimming is a thing for
swimming
you.
Swimming is a thing for
and
me.
And it's been. So it's, when did that start?
Yeah. So first of all, for those of you who don't know me, I am a large human. I am 6'1", and I have been big my entire life. But I was incredibly clumsy as a small child because my hands and my feet grew faster than the rest of me. I mean, I was in first grade wearing a size 6 shoe. So, I mean, I was always big and clumsy as all get out. So I couldn't play basketball. Trying me with a soccer ball was ridiculous. So my family was like, yeah, we got to put her someplace safe. And so they threw me into the water. So
okay.
that was kind of the start of my swimming. And I
okay.
was like, oh, I can
do
this.
And you are good at it.
I don't know so
Eventually.
Much of that. Yeah, I think it was,
Eventually.
Oh, I like this.
Gotcha.
And I think, because I think you become better at things that you like.
Yes.
So I started swimming on like a small little club team in elementary school and then got into a competitive team when I was in middle school. And I tell you, swimming has just been probably the most pivotal thing in my life because it has always been a part of my life. And it led me to being able to go to college at Florida State. I didn't swim, but I ran all of their aquatic programs. I got a graduate assistantship in aquatics that paid for my master's degree. When I moved back home and I was working for the school system, I also taught swim lessons on the side, which allowed me to save money to buy a house as a 24-year-old. So swimming has always been just very important to me. And in the space where I am now, it is absolutely my way of just self-care.
So when does that start? Does it start the moment you hit the gym and you start to get ready? Or is it when you've got some laps behind you?
Yeah, it's when I first put my feet in whatever the body of water is. Because I think that's the fun part of this
the
conversation
trigger.
Is, so I'll go from a pool, but I also swim open water. So I have had the opportunity to swim in a lot of very interesting places.
Do tell.
Oh, yeah. So there is a swim from the Sunshine Skyway to the Courtney Campbell Causeway. So it's 24 miles.
Far. Wow.
I do it. I've done it a couple of times with a couple of other people. And so we each have a swim leg. My legs were always underneath the bridges. So I have swam under the Gandhi Bridge. I've swam under the Howard Franklin Bridge. Mm. And there is nothing like swimming under a large bridge because you don't realize. And I've also accidentally swam underneath the Courtney Campbell when I got yanked.
I was
going to
say,
I got yanked. The current was so bad, I couldn't fight the current, and it pulled me under the span.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've had a lot of really fun opportunities.
She called that fun.
Yeah. You just did Alcatraz, right?
I did. We did Alcatraz.
I think
Alcatraz.
That's where you were when I was like, what?
Yeah. So that was an incredible – it was a bucket list swim for me, mainly because the water temperatures is significantly colder than what we have here in Tampa. I had an opportunity to swim out there in March, and the water temperature was 52. I don't wear a wetsuit. Again, large human. Mm. Body by Budweiser is what I call it. I've got plenty of padding. So it was – but a lot of it was just mental for me of just mentally going, can I swim in 52-degree water? Because I just didn't know if I could do it or not. And I had really like got my head all messed up. And then I did. I was like, oh, I can do this.
Wow.
So when I got to swim Alcatraz, the water temperature was 62. So that was like, oh, this is no big deal. So
what's the point of what your body reacts to water temperature? Like what – I don't know, 62 versus 52 versus – at what
it's
point
like, – it's training. I mean, so
– okay. So it is not a capacity issue.
Correct.
It is a – meaning the body – you know, because you see whatever TV show or movie about someone goes into the water and that's it. It's too cold. They're gone.
Yeah.
Right.
You would swim into train. What degree water would you swim in without a wetsuit? Where, how far do you think you could go? I don't know if this
having
matters,
done 52 degrees where I swam for 45 minutes with no adverse side effects, meaning I didn't go into hypothermia. I think I could go under 50 now. I think my head would, I think my head could get me to 49,
right.
48 or 49 degrees. Wow. I'm not sure I could go much, but if I could do 48 or 49, then that would say, oh, maybe I could do 45.
Yes.
This is the problem
this is a personal
every competitive
yes.
athlete.
Yes. Yes.
So what is going on? You know, this is like a de-stressor. This is like second nature to you. What are you thinking? Like, I think about even people who run. Like, seriously.
I can't, no.
For, like, Thomas does, you
Mr.
know,
Marathon.
He's,
uh-huh.
yes, Mr. Marathon. Like, what are you thinking? Is that how you de-stress? Do you check out? Like, all depending on the day?
Yeah, so particularly open water. You want to talk about complete sensory deprivation.
Mm.
Normally, I have headphones or I have earplugs in.
Right.
So I can't hear. Most of the places I swim, it's murky water. And so, so you really, I have found, and it took me a while to get there, that I can just like completely zone out.
Yeah, you can.
And just go, and then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, crap, I'm here. All right, yay me. So that is
you have
that
to.
Is
otherwise,
wonderful.
Mentally, it is so taxing. If all you're thinking, you have to get to a place where you, if you're doing any sort of endurance, you have to get to a place where you let go.
Mm.
You know, in a marathon, your first couple of miles, you're thinking about this, thinking about that, and it'll drive you crazy.
Mm.
You just have to find a place, right, where you go into. I've done some triathlons, not full but halves and Olympics, and you know, getting out there in an open water swim is always particularly when stuff bumps you.
I was going to say, what about the critters?
That freaks me out. You're just cruising along, getting a little swim in, boink. You're like, oh, God. Your next thought is,
ouch.
Am I going to lose a leg?
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Let me get two of those.
Is
yeah.
the next thing like in Jaws, there's a giant bite,
right?
And I'm suddenly one-legged?
Like the Jaws poster where it's coming up.
Right.
Uh-huh. I've had one experience with that. I was swimming underneath the Gandhi Bridge, and I had something knock me so hard it kind of pushed me off track. And I did, of course, scream. Like, but I was fine, so I just kept going. And so it was like kind of after that experience, I'm like, okay, I'm all right.
But I want to
– go ahead.
I want to ask one question about this because of it's kind of what Shannon was talking about before, but because it relates to our work. Do you think that plumbing the depths of your capacity as a swimmer has helped you as a caregiver?
As a caregiver? That's an interesting phrase.
Because you've been able to push yourself in places that you never thought you could go to from a physical perspective, right? Remember the first time I thought about running a marathon and I drove 26 miles just by coincidence. I'm thinking, what kind of moron could run 20? Right? Who does this?
Yeah.
Who does this? But has your endurance training, has your ability to push yourself, whether it's by degrees or by race or into places of fear and discomfort, has that informed you as a human and in the work that you do at all, do you think? This is a really deep podcast.
Yeah.
This
is, no,
you're not in Candyland here. This
is... Answer your own question.
No, I asked her.
I know, but she's going to answer. But after, you would...
Yes, right. I think that any time that you push yourself beyond boundaries that you knew you had, wherever it is, mm-hmm. you have a different appreciation for who you are. And I think that sense of yourself, right, informs how you... can take on. So mm-hmm. all of us that do this work, we talked about this at the, in the stress part of the conversation, all of us that do this work are taking on a level of obligation impact. Again, we'll talk more about the crisis center, but the work you all do, the shoulders that, you know, you talked about being a big person. For the rest of us, we're really glad you have big shoulders because what you're asked to carry is staggering.
Yeah.
Right. So going back to the question, I don't know if there's an answer to it or an easy answer.
I don't know if there's an answer to it either. Mm. I only because this is all I've known, so I don't know a before or after.
Yeah.
Mm. So, I mean, has it, you know, chicken and egg kind of thing. Is it, am I a better endurance athlete because of what I do or vice versa?
Yeah. Well, I also find in my
your
levels.
Your big brain always hurts my little brain, so could you tone it down there,
Don't swell him too much further.
Your husband's really smart. Where's he?
I know, please. You want to get Corey on here?
You know, I have found over time in particular, and this is kind of part of the same question, which is why I think it tends to be probably the answers both. But I have found when I am particularly stressed, my exercise regimen becomes much more punishing.
Mm.
Right?
Hmm.
Because I need something to push me harder, to help me, right? So it's a de-stress technique, but it's also something that I think that gives me a sense of control. Like one of the things about exercise, which you know well, you talked about the gangliness of your own physical self early on. Swimming taught you body control. Mm. And the more that you learn control, one of the great things about exercise is you learn a lot of physical control. Mm-hmm. You know how to, right? And it gives you a sense of yourself from a body image and a body perspective, right? I think it also does the same for me, and I think for a lot of people, emotionally and intellectually and spiritually, if you view it that way. That communion you're in the middle of dark water alone is a pretty deep communion.
Yeah.
And it's nice because I can invite the crisis center in or not,
correct,
depending upon what I need at that moment. Yeah. So
I'm sorry, we still don't know who Claire is.
Do it. No, but we do. We're learning. But my question is this. I have really two. Is it about control for you guys? Like if it, you mentioned it's all you've known, which we'll get to in a second.
Yeah.
But is swimming or is running, if you're saying it's like a tougher time in your life, is that about something that you control?
Mm.
You know, because it feels like you can't control everything else because you can go back to the art, right? That you're painting, that's something you're controlling. Is that what fuels?
Yeah, I think it's, I think it's part and parcel of the whole thing. I think when, for me, and again, you're the guest, so you should, you know, jump in if you choose.
Oh, so
you choose
kind
to be
of
on
you.
The choose to be on the podcast. You know, it's up to you.
Thank you for the invite.
Right.
You know, I think all of these things are about being able to, as I said, I think about the mechanical nature. It's to put pieces together and to do things that we can accomplish that give us a sense that there is a start and a finish and a process and, you know, losing. I think all of those things matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think physical exercise is just another part of that process where I do feel a better sense of ownership of who I am. I've started working out in the mornings, which I normally was an afternoon guy, but I've started working out in the mornings because it's helping me through the day, right? I know you're an early morning
swimmer. Yeah, I can't get it done otherwise. I think for me, it's maybe it's because, again, I don't think the way he thinks, but for me, it's a structure.
Okay.
And it provides for me that I know I'm going to do this from this time to this time. And I always have a group. So I have a very social group. So I've got a group of guys that if I don't show up to the pool, I am catching heck from that moment
on. They think something is wrong too.
Yeah. Oh, no. They don't. It's more of, you know, get your lazy butt out of bed. Let's go, you know, slacker. So I have found that it just gives me a different, just a completely different group that I'm just Claire the swimmer. I'm not Claire the CEO. I'm not Claire the wife. I'm not Claire the mom. I am just Claire the swimmer with a couple of other guys that like to just bust me whenever they can. So
that's important.
It's a ton of fun.
Yeah. So you mentioned crisis and you said it's all I've known.
Hmm.
help us understand what is.
Yeah,
what is
so that? For me, I'm meaning more on the swimming side of things. Mm-hmm. But for, yeah, I mean, I think that that's a very good phrase. Mm-hmm. All I have known is nonprofit work.
Mm-hmm. Got you.
I was very fortunate. I really started my career as a child protective investigator when I was working on my master's in social work at Florida State, and that is crisis work. If anything. And I can remember the one case that really just cemented that this is what I was meant to do. Mm-hmm. I had a report come in. It was a conditions hazardous report, and it was a mom, and she has two young children. And so they invited me into the house, and I'm all of 21. I think I'm all that in a bag of chips. And so the allegation was, again, conditions hazardous. So I go through the house. The house is very clean, plenty of food. I mean, it's just really a nice place. And I asked the mom, I said, I really need to, speak to your daughter. Do you mind? So they allowed me to speak to the daughter, and come to find out that the mom was the paramour for the drug dealer in the community. And so they were running a lot of the drugs out of that house. It was economically how they managed. Mm. And what the mother didn't know is that, thinking that the little girl was asleep, she could actually weigh and measure cocaine better than any drug dealer I had ever known at that time.
Wow.
Mom had no idea. She had no clue that her daughter knew about it, and that was how the report was generated. So, so we worked out a plan, and I'm feeling like I'm all that in a bag of chips. I'm walking out of the house, and guns start firing.
Whoa.
Bullets are flying. I hit the ground. There were two young children that I take down with me. I'm like crab walking to my car because I was interfering with the economic engine of the community.
Whoa.
Wow. At 21, I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
And obviously, if they had wanted to really hurt me, they could have.
Right.
It was a really good warning shot for, a white young woman that was walking into a community. Mm-hmm. And I had no really good social background and cultural competence to be able to do. So I cried for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
After that, I thought, I can never do this. And I had a great supervisor who really helped me to understand. And I always go back to that place 30 some odd years ago because it was such a grounding moment for me of recognizing this opportunity that I have whenever I get a chance to have it of entering into somebody's life and being a partner with them. And taking the time to really understand what their better looks like that's not necessarily mine.
Yeah.
And so that has I think that has also helped me to go back to the de-stress place because in the work that we do at the Crisis Center, we are touching folks at their worst moment in their lives.
Yeah.
Sometimes it happens accidentally. Sometimes it happens because of the choices people make, and they find themselves in these places. And so being able to be a partner with them and provide different opportunities, different resources that they ultimately can choose to take or not take. And I think that for me, it took me the longest to be able to pivot to that place.
Wow. What led you to social work to begin with?
Yeah. So I am from Tampa, born and raised. My mother was the first female to go through the police academy here in Tampa.
Wow.
So she was the first law enforcement officer. And she went through the police academy, had spent, almost like 13 years. And she had done everything. Mm-hmm. And so this was in the early 70s. And so this is, she was definitely a trailblazer, had worked in vice, had worked in prostitution, all of those things. And single mom. Mm-hmm. So it was me and my mom. I had a maternal grandmother who lived with us as well. And one evening, she went into her bedroom, which was really close to me. She told me she was going to kill herself. I heard her pull her weapon out, and I walked in as she did.
Wow.
So in just a very short span, I lost my major parent.
Yeah.
And it was I ended up in the child welfare system after that. My grandmother couldn't take care of me. And so I was in that system.
How old were you?
I was 15 at the time that happened. So but when I had the opportunity, school was always a great place for me. Mm. So – and I had swimming.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this group that pulled me through. Ended up being able to go to college. Went on scholarship. Thank God for Pell Grants. There's nothing like a good Pell Grant to help somebody through college. And I immediately was drawn to psychology. So I got an undergrad in psychology and was thinking I would do a master's, and social work just spoke to me.
Yeah.
Because social work is the hands-on role that I really wanted to have. And so I got my master's in social work. I was, you know, 20 something years old, and I have been doing that work ever since. And I'm 55 now. So for over 30 years, I have worked in this field. And I know some folks always question, you know, am I doing what I'm supposed to do? I've always felt that I've been on the path that I need to be. So
that's a gift.
Right? Wow. So you also started, you're with the Crisis Center, which we're, again, we keep saying we're going to get to. But you started your own nonprofit.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and then how that led you to the Crisis
Center. Sure. So when I moved back home to Tampa from Tallahassee, I worked for the school system. I was a school social worker. Best job in the entire world. In fact, I think when I finish this phase of my life, I'd love to retire as a school social worker because there was nothing more fun. I worked in a variety of settings, though, with children and working with children with severe emotional and behavioral challenges, all of that kind of fun stuff. And so the Children's Board of Hillsborough County here locally had gotten a big federal grant to really redesign how we look at children who have severe emotional and behavioral challenges. I was the school district representative at the time, and through all of that kind of work, the Children's Board wanted to create something different. They wanted to create an independent case management program, which basically just meant that we could work with families and, again, get them to their place of better, however that needed to look like, outside of just creating another program. So we created services and all sorts of stuff. In order to do that, they needed an organization. And one of the things that makes me so different from my friend over here is that I'm more of a ready, shoot, aim kind of girl. Gotcha. I am not a big planner. I just figure we'll build this plane as we fly. And so when the school district said, you know, we really need a vehicle to do this, I'll just start a nonprofit. How hard can it be?
I retired to nonprofit.
Yeah, so I was 29 years old. I didn't know what I didn't know, but I think there was something freeing from that.
Yeah.
You can't be scared. So.
Yeah.
So that was how Success for Kids and Families started. There were three of us and a little grant from the Children's Board. And when I left 10 years later, we had been able to grow to $5 million. We had 40 employees. And what we learned is that kids and families do better when they're together, number one. Programs are oftentimes like a Big Mac. You get two all-beef patties, special sauce, cheese, lettuce, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun, even if you're a vegetarian. What we learned is that when you give families choice and active participation in what it takes to get better, and you give them the financial resources to do that so they can build their own plan with their own budget, they do tremendously well. And we were able to take that working with some of the most difficult and expensive children that were in residential placements. That's how we started. We started taking five kids from the deepest in residential placements. So five kids from child welfare, juvenile justice, mental health, substance abuse, and education. We brought them out of facilities, brought them back to the community, wrapped them tight with amazing services and support. And lo and behold, these kids did unbelievably well. And so we were able to demonstrate that, and then we sold it. We sold it to other funders. We sold it to other groups, and we got some great investment, and we were able to really make it flourish. And, you know, Success for Kids and Families continued for 10 years, and then when the executive director left, who replaced me, the group and the board decided they needed a little bit more infrastructure and support. So in January, it became a part of the Crisis Center. So Success for Kids and Families is now a division of the Crisis Center of Tampa Bay.
So it came back to you.
It came back home.
Full circle.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Wow. Okay, Crisis Center.
Did not script that at all.
Yeah.
Which Thomas would have. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Thomas would have had this massive master plan.
Yes.
Claire's just like, well, you know,
well,
let's
see
how this works.
It lands in the same place, right? Yeah.
You had a question? No? Okay, so Crisis Center.
Yes, ma'am.
Before Thomas kind of takes over with the business side.
Yes.
Describe the Crisis Center in three words.
Three words.
Three words.
Good luck.
Help hope healing.
Oh.
So there you go.
Well done, you.
Yeah, that was impressive.
Help, hope, healing. So, Claire, it is impossible for me to kind of step past your personal experience without kind of coming back to that. And I, you know, it's always tricky to have a conversation about something like you went through. But let me ask you this. You now have 40 years of perspective on that moment and that occurrence.
Yes.
How have you figured out, have you made peace with it? How does it inform you today? How has it defined who you are as a person? You know, the story is shocking to hear, and I've heard it a few times now, and I still remain shocked and sad. It just doesn't fail to, because I know you well and admire you and feel strongly about you, it doesn't fail to hurt me. But how have you made your peace? How have you made your way through that? How is it that you filed that or used it or managed it? I think anybody listening to this would want to ask that question.
Yeah.
Of you.
I think for the beginning of my career, it was always simmering in the background, but I never talked about it. And I was still bitter and probably pretty angry about it. You know, as a kid, you don't understand the whys. You don't understand any of that. You're pretty selfish in your perspective. And I think many of us have a selfish view of suicide, as if it's quote unquote the easy way out. I think for me, coming to the crisis center was such an important part for me, not only from a professional standpoint, but also personally. Mm-hmm. I think it helped me really to be able to come to grips with the suicide, to really be able to learn and understand that, you know, suicide is one of those things that is very a person feels very isolated. They feel like there's no place better. And they also feel like they are such a burden to everybody else. They're actually doing the world a favor, their family a favor. And that was important for me. That was important for me to kind of to understand that. I also really emotionally started really understanding the impact of trauma. Yeah. And that trauma untreated does not go away. And for our first responder community who live in trauma every single day, I think it when I got to a place where I could talk my story, it was to law enforcement of just trying to say, look, more first responders, particularly law enforcement, die by suicide than in the line of duty, but we don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. It is the suck it up buttercup culture. Yeah. It is pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And so while we had spent a lot of time earlier in my professional career talking about veterans and suicide, we had not shifted that conversation to first responders. And so I think I was in a really cool place personally and professionally to be able to talk about it from a license as a licensed clinical social worker, but then also to be able to humanize it I am the daughter of a first responder who died by suicide. So I think it gave me an opportunity to really have a very open and honest conversation.
May I ask you one more question?
Always.
So you talked early on about the fact that, you know, you talked with pride about your mother's accomplishments as being the first that has gone into this profession and the difficult challenges she took on as a police officer to begin with, and I'm sure twice as difficult as a female police officer. And so the inference I draw from that is your admiration of her.
Yes.
How do you reconcile that with the decision she made, and how do you understand those today? Mm-hmm. Do you understand why she did what she did? Do you have a sense of that, or have you been able to say that was her life and her circumstances? Mm-hmm. How do you make your way through that?
I think that there's a couple of things. I think, first of all, there is a whole hell of a lot of trauma there that nobody recognized and knew about. There was also substance use that I think I'll never know if it was an impulsive suicide. It felt impulsive to me versus premeditated.
Okay.
But that's a question I'll always have. And maybe the best thing is, what do I want it to be? Mm-hmm. I want it to be impulsive. So I think that that's the place that I have come to as well, because I don't have any answers. So I might as well use the answer that's going to help me to be able to move forward. Mm-hmm. And I guess, Thomas, at the end of the day, for me, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah, it's.
So I don't know that I would have gone down the road that I went on without this experience.
Yeah.
And I think it has made me a better person in the role that I'm in now because I've experienced it.
Yeah, it's interesting how we process and use trauma, right? The concept of the wounded healer is often, you know, part of the lexicon of those that do this work on a regular basis. And I have often found that the wounded healer is by far the most effective. One of the things I think about leadership, but I also think it's about this work, is that I would say about leadership that the better leaders are able to be vulnerable at depth. That when you're able to step into your vulnerability, it's when folks will come with you and alongside you to do what you're doing. And it's a lot of the trauma that you have to make your way through that allows you to be, you know, that emotional connector. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I admire, there are many, many reasons why I admire you, but one of them is your willingness to step into that vulnerability and that loss and that pain and allow it to inform the way you became a leader and a provider of services in the community. And so, again, I just want to say from our perspective, you know, there's many reasons why we love you. And you know, it's one of them right now is for being willing to share that with us. Thank you.
Thank you. And believe me, it took me a long time to get there.
Can only imagine. Can only imagine.
You know, and I really do have truly the crisis center to thank to help – that helped me get there.
Yeah, I would certainly say that having – made my way through my own issues in my life, this work has allowed me to understand more of, you know, what formed me, both good and bad, right? And I think, as I said, those that are really good at what they do are able to draw upon the experiences they have and use them. I think there are folks, you and I have talked about this privately, there are folks in our industry, and for the listener, we'll move this in a bit of a different direction. There are folks in our industry that we jokingly refer to as a bit of posers, right? Right.
But the ones with the utmost love and respect, of course, Thomas Mann.
But also judgmentally. Importantly, just to be clear.
We speak the truth here.
Yeah. I do think, you know, I do think that greater leaders, and there are many of them, you and I get together with them with, you know, there are many of those leaders that have been able to step in and say, okay, you know, this is who I am and this is how I lead. So let's talk a little bit about it. I want to move into the concept of crisis and crisis center. You said a few minutes ago on the in one of your remarks that you know, the challenges are greater than they ever have been. The crises are deeper. We see that the same thing. The work and the pressure and all of that in our world continues to escalate. And so the question I have for you, and I don't know if this is a question that works, is how do you define crisis now? And has the definition of it changed over time? Like we would say the conversation about food insecurity is completely different today than it was 10 years ago. How do you define crisis today? What do you look at that as? How would someone understand your description of that?
Well, for us, we define crisis as someone who is experiencing a life challenge and they need help finding a solution.
So to them, it's a crisis.
To them, it's a crisis.
Okay.
Because crisis is so individualized. Food insecurity may be black and white. Crisis, what we find is that it's impacted by your experience. It's impacted by your culture. What may be a crisis for me may not be for you and vice versa. So we also talk a lot about, you know, there's no issue that's too big or too little either.
Right.
We prefer for folks to come to us when it's small because then you can solve issues quickly. Similar to in your industry, right?
You know, prevention is always better than intervention.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just that small intervention. But one of the things that we find is that, you know, everybody goes, oh, it's not me. Oh, it's not me. Until they are literally holding on, you know, by the ledge. So I would say that because we see crisis from that broad spectrum, the definition for us has not changed. What people are coming to us for.
I was going to say, so the complexity of crisis has changed.
The complexity of crisis has absolutely changed. Part of that, I would say, is it's for the better because of the pandemic, because there was so much stigma around the work that we do. And no, I can't say that word. And now, particularly in many of our younger generations, we are seeing people actively talking about their mental health, actively talking about trauma and crisis. And so that has changed tremendously. So I think it has helped us in some respects to be able to have more conversations more often.
And maybe the answer to this is going to be, you know, both and. Do you think we are a more vulnerable people today or a more resilient people today?
Based on what you see. I think we're more vulnerable. It's the resiliency that worries me. And I think that that's where all of us are going to have to get to, particularly with these younger generations. They're recognizing that they're struggling, but they want their therapist to fix everything. And it is – we have to change the conversation of you have got so much skill in you already. You've got so many things within you. Let's help you harness that to solve your own problems and your own crises. And I don't think we're quite there yet.
So do you think that people don't have an understanding that problems can't be – so the way I was raised in this kind of therapeutic environment was that all the solutions start inside you, right? That this is about – just like we talked about with athletics, this is about digging deep. And finding out, you know, causes and conditions and whys. And do you think that there is more of a sense of I noticed – so one of my other outlets is I watch a lot of murder shows, a lot of people who have horrific things happen to them. I have to go through that, right? It's an observation. My wife often shares that I don't know why you're watching this stuff.
Really uplifting. I would say not uplifting at all.
No.
Right? Psychologically, there's an answer there somewhere, right? But one of the things I notice in all of these shows, there is one common thing. They all drink. Like that's an ongoing social answer to stress, right? They're going to knock back a hard one. The policeman coming home at the end of the day, the person's – right? So it appears more and more as you watch this, crisis management is external tools and kits, resources. But as you just said, people don't necessarily want to explore the internal.
Right.
How do you start to – what do you say to that and how do we start to think about that?
I think some of it starts with first of all, you've got to let people purge whatever's on their heart. And that's the first piece is that when we have folks call us, it is the symptom of the day. It is that one thing that has pushed them over the edge. But there is a whole heck of a lot of stuff in that basket. So allowing people that opportunity just to get all of that stuff off their chest, pulling out the key words and the key phrases. So then you start building those building blocks of hope. And sometimes you have to help folks see that. Oh, wow, Thomas, you talked a lot about this family that's driving you crazy. But can you tell me more about why this why these people are important to you? Reframing conversations, helping people see the resources that they have around them that they can then almost quilt together for themselves. I think that's the really cool part of the journey.
So going back to the vulnerable versus resilient, do you think people have toolkits that they need? Are they being taught toolkits to manage? Because life is going to have stress and trauma. There's no way you can get through this unscathed, right? We all agree on that, that you're just going to take your knocks. The question is, do you learn how to deal with those? Do you think that people have the toolkits they need, the resources that they need?
No.
Okay, well, that's helpful. Thank you. We'll just end the entire
I don't. I really don't. Why do you think that is?
How has society changed that there aren't toolkits? Like what is going back? Is it more complex or more difficult or they're just
– I'll personalize this. So I have a son, Corey. He's 23. He's a college student.
I don't know that he agreed to be on the podcast,
well,
but here
he
is. Right.
Yeah,
she's the mom.
She gets to call it. And I was as guilty of it as anybody else. The bubble wrapping that we do of our kids, of feeling like I had to come in and protect him, that I, you know, had to do stuff for him. I think that, you know, back when I was young, you kind of just, you fell down and,
you're good.
You're okay. And so I learned that I was okay. Corey, who is just this remarkable person, but he also had to kind of learn that on his own too. He doesn't need mom. He can do it on his own. So I think that there's a little bit of that in trying to make our kids' lives better. We may have done a little too much for them.
So we may have taken away their ability to learn the tools and techniques of, right? I was talking to a dad that I play golf with the other day, and he was talking about his son being on the Little League team. And it's always interesting to hear parents talk about, I think his kid is 5 or 6, and he was, you know, he said, I'm really trying to help him learn what it means to be on a team, what it means to lose, what it means to win, what it means, right? You know, and I was reflecting on that kind of lesson that, you know, as you said, we can oftentimes step in and interfere with a child's ability to learn from these things, mm-hmm. right? Because they we want to protect, right? As opposed to letting them go through the pain. I certainly was of the generation that at the time I went through it, I thought it was awful. Mm. Of, you know, how I learned to swim, I literally was thrown into a river.
Same. Mm.
Right? So, and that sounds like a horrible story. Now, one level, the person that did it, I don't think they had positive parenting in mind. So that's problematic in and of itself. But the lesson I learned from it was helpful to me. And I think that's the funny, the dichotomy of mm-hmm. all this, going back to your own personal story. You would never wish what you went through on your worst enemy.
Absolutely not.
Ever. But as you said, that trauma informed the human you are today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I wonder sometimes, going back to this resiliency question, we have had the conversation here a lot. The one thing I love about Feeding Tampa Bay is we have 200 individuals, and every single one of them, you said, is very, very different. But a common theme that we see over and over again is people are struggling to deal with just life on life's terms. And it's not a criticism of them.
No.
It's an understanding of them. Mm-hmm. And part of what we're going through as an organization is, what do we do about that? We want to be a place that can help. How do we have a conversation to say, here's a we had a discussion at our recent all-staff meeting where we talked about, we did a word cloud thing, mm-hmm. right? We asked everybody to put in, how are you feeling? And it was tough to see.
Yeah.
You know, people were putting in words where you're like, you're just like, oh. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a dad. I feel like the dad here,
sure.
right? It just breaks your heart because you see people that, you know, teammates that we love and value mm-hmm. and care for, and boy, are they struggling. Mm-hmm. And I just continue to wonder, and it comes back to the crisis center and the work you're doing. How do we as a society start to think about this? What do we do about this? Please give us all an answer.
Yeah, sure.
Solve the problem.
And I think you I think
because you you're all that in a bag of chips.
Yeah that's true. Doritos some days.
Doritos.
I think it goes back to the resiliency and kind of where we started this conversation to begin with. There's that glass. Yeah, we talk about the glass as half full or half empty. It's your choice how you choose to see that. I think that we've got to, you know, as you were talking about what your staff is experiencing, yes, it's horrific, but it's also an opportunity. Hmm. It's an opportunity when you are in the struggle. You never learn anything when everything is happy. You never grow right. when everything is great. Mm-hmm. You grow in the struggle. You grow when things are tough. That's how you learn. That's how you move forward. And so I think that if we do a better job, all of us, as a collective, of giving people the opportunity just to be heard, mm-hmm. let them voice whatever that is without judgment, without chiming in, without saying, oh, I've got it worse than you do, give them the space to do that, and then help them be able to see the resiliency within their own selves. That's how we're going to get there.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah,
but that 75 cents will buy you soda.
So this is also it's helpful for me for understanding when I get up behind Shannon on the left hand lane of the interstate where she's just driving along. So now I have a tool or technique I can use. I know we want to. Shannon has one last part that we want to talk about, but let me ask you one last question about your work. How do you think about where you go from here and where we go from here? So much of your work is plugged into the issue of the moment, the circumstance of the moment, and let me make sure that this human that has come before us is receiving the care mm-hmm. that they need in that moment. But surely you must be thinking about, what do we do over the longer term? Mm-hmm. What's on your mind? What should we think about as we look towards where you think you're going, but also where we need to go?
And I think some of it goes back to the conversation we were having in this political sphere that we're in. Part of the work that we do at the Crisis Center is we run a medical transportation division called TransCare. The interesting thing about this EMS or Emergency Medical Service Transportation is that, you know, it is basically taking somebody who is in a crisis, they're calling 911, and they need to go to a hospital. As, you know, depending upon what happens politically, we may see more and more of our neighbors in our community no longer have health insurance.
Right.
So our work is going to really shift. It's going to shift to have more people calling because they're going to end up getting more of their medical care in the ER. Okay, what can we do differently? Where is the opportunity here? We believe that there's an opportunity to be able to provide some service in the home. particularly for some things where the family doesn't need to go to a hospital. Mm. But we're going to have to change some legislation. Right. We got to make some of those pieces happen. So I am looking forward to looking at a process called community paramedicine where we can provide more of that. We're also dealing with, obviously, a lot of substances still. We've gotten really involved in this opioid space, but it's also opened our eyes to other substances that's impacting our neighbors. So what can we do in that space? Mm-hmm. So I do see opportunity there as well. And then some of it, you know, again, you were so kind in talking about responding moment by moment. A lot of that's just my personality. So it fits well in that crisis mm-hmm. space. But I think one of the things that we've learned is how to pivot and how to be able to find ways to be able to help in those situations.
I think one of the things is we, you know, I certainly first want to say we're just such an admirer of what you do, and mm-hmm. our thanks for your being willing to step into it is significant because, as you said, when people come to you, they're at their worst. And having someone like you and your organization be there for folks is just so tremendously important, I think, to all of us as a community. And so we're glad you were able to come and spend some of your time with us here today. I think also I would say this about all of us that do this work in the social services arena. We have to have the willingness and bravery and courage to step beyond response and move into prevention. Now, all of us have to figure out a way to work further upstream, which is what you're talking about to mm-hmm. say. We've got to find – because by the time someone is in their trauma to you, the horror of their lives is already evident to them.
Absolutely.
And we don't want anybody to be there. How do we find ways, whether it's for us, we want to make sure that people have a meal on the table or resources. So we're looking forward to seeing what you do and how you do it and, mm-hmm. and how our community continues to transform. So – thank you for having a chat with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And partnering with us as well.
Yes.
Right? For being a resource for those who come into
our
world.
There's so much we didn't get to in our – we never do. We never get to anything
right?
like
there's
our partnership.
We could go on for – anyway. So there's a question that we ask as we kind of close our time together is if you have a table of four, you are one of them, and you were to invite three other people to your table, who would you invite and what would you serve?
So I would invite Diane Nyad, who is a long-distance open water swimmer, and at the age of 65, swam 90 miles from Cuba to Key West.
Whoa.
Great movie, by the way.
Yeah, I saw the movie too. Yeah.
It was really fascinating to see, you know, what she went through and, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that she'd had five tries. And I mean, at 65, I don't know how anybody has the endurance to be able to do that fortitude or just the bravery mm-hmm. to be able to do something like that. And I would love to invite two other swimmers. I would love to have Katie Ledecky at the table as well. And then Janet Evans. So because you really would have kind of like all the various generations of female long distance swimmers. Yeah. And I would love to just kind of sit back and watch the three of them really have a conversation and be a student in that moment. And then in honor of Diana, because she has a strong Cuban heritage, we'd definitely serve some Cuban food with a seafood flair again because of the swim from Cuba to Key West.
Gosh, I love that. That's a good table.
Yeah.
People always answer this one so differently, and I love it.
Right.
And I love that you've had swimming your whole life as your
thank you.
And
I know we're out of time, but I don't care. I just want to say thank you to Thomas. I mean, when we look at our community, you have always been the thought leader. Mm-hmm. You have always been really ahead of the game. And I listened to one of your podcasts when you talked about like a think tank and you said, I always wanted to be a part of the think tank. You are the think tank. And you take the rest
of us. The community think tank.
Yes. Yep. And you take the rest of us with us. And this place is a beautiful example of your beautiful brain. So thank you. And thank you all so much for the just really the honor to be here today.
Oh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for bringing so much wisdom. I feel like there's so much to take away from today. You know,
there's so much more.
If you guys had to pick one nugget for folks to like really keep in their back pocket from today, what would it be?
So for me, I think I know this already, is that a crisis is very personal. Mm. But I think what I learned in hearing what we heard today is how much more I need to pay attention and respect whatever that crisis may be, whether it might be simple, but in that moment to that person, it is really everything that's taking over their world. So that's the lesson I'm taking away today.
Yeah. Yeah.
I learned what a hero is one more time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah.
You?
You.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. What about you, friend?
I think, you know, to what you were saying about like people not having the tools that they need to get through this, yeah. I think it's something that we take for granted. We think that we're struggling because we are not enough or we're not strong enough. But a lot of us haven't had the training or the opportunity or the support to really get there. And that's key.
Yeah. You know, I shared this, I think, recently, but I just finished Arnold Schwarzenegger's biography.
Yeah.
Interesting guy. And there are reasons for admiration and other concerns. But one of the things I was asked about in an interview, he said, you're very specific. You do not want to be called a self-made man. Mm. Very specific about that. Why? Why are you so adamant about that? And he said, because no one makes it alone.
Yeah.
Everybody has had someone help them. Yeah. And you think about the success of this person and the physical stature of this person, right? Mm. They're everything about the idea that there is a manliness, masculinity, own your own, I'm going to take on the world. And he's very clear in saying, I could not have done this alone.
Right.
Well, that's kind of what this podcast is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We're all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do it alone. And we need to recognize and learn from every conversation we have.
Yeah. I'll be back.
And we'll see you then.
Thanks, everybody.
The Stick a Fork in It podcast is a presentation of Feeding Tampa Bay.